the magic bell. So more people drift in, so I'd appreciate people come back on time, etc. Any question or comment before we keep going?
Nice
one. How was it? Did anybody notice anything about really enjoying it? The people, the pleasure? Yeah? Any resistance to pleasure?
No.
Among the English? Are you kidding? Wow. Okay. Okay, good. All right. So, well, you came back. That's always encouraging. Now, let's see here. So, let me get adjusted. And we sat outside, so I got a little nippy here, so I'm putting on my coat for a little bit of this. All right. So, I'm not presuming that. No one else can. Let up. So music through the walls? Okay, well, it'll be the soundtrack for our workshop here. It's Queen, well. Very good soundtrack. All right. So I won't necessarily cover every single slide, but I would like to talk here. Turning on my remote. Come on. Great. Do. How to use this stuff with other people. So I'd like to cover a few points about this and then talk about the evolution of the brain and the implications of that evolution for this transition from the second to the third noble truth. It was her phone. No worries. Can I get your Karen committee and activated? Now, it's okay. Okay, good. So how do we use this stuff with other people? Right? So, I better regenerate my batteries. Okay, I'll do that later. All right, so if you think about it, there are four ways, I think, to offer a method to anyone, whether it's in a therapy setting or a coaching environment, mindfulness teaching, raising a child, what have you. The first way, and these four ways apply to things like cognitive therapy, or helping people work through insecure attachments, much as they apply to teaching people around taking in the good. So in the first way we use any method with someone is we do it implicitly. We don't draw attention to it. We don't teach it explicitly. We just do it. For example, if, let's say, we have a client in therapy or we're in a situation with a child where there's some kind of useful state going. You know, they have a nice experience of gardening and what that feels like, or maybe there's the belief beginning to stabilize in their mind. I'm not responsible for my partner's drinking. He's responsible for his drinking. It's not my fault. That's useful. State of mind, right? Or maybe something subtle, like what's it like to stay centered and present while someone's angry with you, without fighting back immediately in the moment to make them go away. What's that one? Okay? So we see that something useful is present, and then implicitly we protect it. We try to preserve it. A lot of the way this shows up clinically is we interrupt a tendency toward distraction. Rather than the person bouncing away from this useful experience, we help them stay with it. We slow things down. We ask them how it feels. I say, could you say more about that? Oh, really? What else? Is there perhaps another thing you could notice about this experience? We do this implicitly. Again, I did not invent taking the good. Good therapists tend to do it naturally. Right? So that's the first way to use this with people, the implicit. Second is to teach it explicitly and leave it up to them. We might say, one way or another, hey, if you really want to grow more of these good things inside yourself, or, for example, if you want to develop more feelings of self-worth and feeling more secure in your relationships with other people, if you want, you could look for good facts around you in which others are friendly or like you or appreciate you or value you. Or you could look for good facts around you in which you're accomplishing things or acting in a way that, you know, is virtuous in some sense or good intentions in your heart. You could look for these facts, and then you could allow that or help that become some kind of useful experience of, let's say, feeling cared about or feeling accomplished or feeling like a good person. You could let yourself have that experience, and then to really help that experience sink into you so it becomes more and more of this inner strength you're growing inside yourself of feeling self-worthy. You could stay with the experience 10, 20 seconds in a row, so it really has a chance to encode a neural structure. You could do that if you want to do it. It's up to you. Right? That's one way, that's the second way we work with methods. We name it, we describe it, and we leave it up to the person. Now, this is a particularly useful way with people who are, you know, focused on autonomy, you know, generalization, teenagers, and, you know, just leave it, name it, move on. It's gross generalization and exceptions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, that's the second one. The third way is we take people through. And, you know, having taught it to people and explained why it's useful, often in a very short, informal, down-to-earth way of speaking, have it, enjoy it, right? I find describing this neuropsychology of emotional learning, this positive neuroplasticity, taking in the good, I find that talking about it in a very natural way, not mysterious, dropping a little brain lingo in to motivate that light bulb to want to change, you know, a little of that stuff goes a long way. Okay, so in the third way of offering a method, we teach it and then we take them through it. So, hey, let's slow it down. I notice that you're telling, like, for example, a client comes in and says, yeah, you know, my boss said something that bothered me. So I went up to her and I said, basically, you said something that bothered me. And I was really afraid to do that, stirred up my, you know, material with my own fault-finding parents or what have you. But she was amazing. It actually went kind of okay. She was a little taken aback. She kind of contradicted me a bit, but we got through that part. And I really felt heard. Wow. So what do we do then? We just kind of let it go by? Or do we say, whoa, let's go back to that. You know, let's use this as an opportunity to really let this one land. This one's a keeper. This experience of speaking up, being assertive, risking the dreaded experience, and having it go well, you know, being relatively received. It's not perfect, but it went reasonably well. And you were seen and you were valued and you were respected. What an opportunity to let yourself have that experience. So let's do it right now for half a minute, we say to them. I won't stare at you. I have to tell people that. I'll look away, you know, and make some more comfortable. And, or sometimes, not always, but just let it sink in. Isn't that nice? I'll be quiet. Great. So we do it explicitly, one way or another. We can do it in group settings as well, right? For example, in a classroom setting where teachers are using these methods more and more, you know, like coming back from recess is a natural opportunity for a little chance to take in the good. What was fun about recess? What nice experience did you have? Was there anything you're grateful for? Or maybe at the end of the day, you know, what did you learn today? Or what was one nice thing you can think about yourself? And let yourself kind of have a nice feeling of that. Great. So we can do that with people in formal settings, in group environments. I think in mindfulness training, when I've looked, I'm not formally trained as an MBSR teacher, but I've, of course, taught meditation for a long time. And when I see the protocols for MBSR, the scripts for, it's fantastic training. It's great. And I can see lots of little opportunities there to take the extra 10 seconds to let the learning really land, you know, both explicitly and implicitly. And then the fourth way we use this material with people, we use any kind of method, we teach it, we encourage the person to use it on their own, maybe with some follow-up. Right. It's like CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. Little assignments. Sometimes people like making little charts. I resist these charts because I had controlling parents. I don't know. But anyway, but a lot of people love them. Like, for example, and I have several in the book, you can modify hardwiring happiness or just make up your own chart. Like, the days of the week are rows, and then the columns are one or more specific key experiences a person is looking to have or ways of practicing with their experiences. And then they check, you know, all the times they did it. Many clients love doing this stuff. Even kids love this. Look at all my check marks. Good client. You know, it's great. It's motivating. Whatever. You know, whatever you measure tends to get better. So it's a way of measuring it, right? So they go off and they do it. That's the part of it. Okay, that's the general framework of this altogether. Yeah. Okay, so kids, we'll talk a bit about kids. I spoke a bit about that previously. I think all kids benefit from practicing taking in the good and letting useful experiences land. Children who are struggling with difficult situations, particularly, I think, benefit from growing resources inside. Also, kids who are more at the anxious, rigid end of the spectrum or the spirit of ADHD. Other end of the temperamental spectrum, the normal range here. Those kids in particular also benefit from taking the good. These anxious, rigid kids tend to be focused overly on the negative, and they're almost afraid to feel good because they're going to lower their guard and be smacked by life. On the other hand, more spirited kids tend to have more positive mood, but they're zooming on from one experience after another before the current beneficial experience has enough time to really convert into some kind of neural structure. I find with children that just saying a little bit about the brain and helping them realize that if they stay with useful, enjoyable experiences, they'll sink in and they can be the boss of their own mind. They tend to be naturally motivated. Also, with kids roughly 4 to 14 who will put up with some psychobabble to extend their bedtime, just before sleep is a very good time to take a few extra minutes to, you know, call up some positive experience, sometimes one that's particularly useful for that child. And I'll get to that in a little bit, this idea of antidote experiences or key resource experiences. Call up that experience, you know, grandma loves you, I love you, Bowser, the foot of the bed loves you, you're loved, you kick that going football, you know, da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, it feels nice, it's kind of hanging out, sinking in, the body's like a sponge, water going in, yum, how nice, yeah. I initially suggested that to parents just kind of as a throwaway. Like, well, if Johnny or Susie, what have you, you could do this thing at night. And then like, people come back a week or two or three later and say, wow, I thought that was kind of stupid, Rick, no offense, but we tried it. And we've been really startled. So, yes, part of the impact of doing this little practice with kids just before bed is just having more time with parents, right? It being special and having that nice coziness. I also think there's something specific or particular to the deliberate internalization of useful experiences again and again and again. Okay. Oh, I pushed the button, but the slide didn't move. Sorry about that. All right. So, okay, so far, keep going. We kind of moved through this briskly. All right, great. So, mindfulness and taking the good. TG, taking the good. All right. So, on the one hand, mindfulness training, attention training, in effect, really supports cultivation because attention is a combination of spotlight and vacuum cleaner. Yes, neurons that fire together, wire together throughout the nervous system, but they do so especially for whatever's in the field of focused attention. Right? Mother Nature wants us to learn from what we pay attention to. The problem is the spotlight of attention is very, very skittery, including because of the fact that we live in a kind of ADD culture, right? But whatever that spotlight of attention is resting on, It's like a vacuum cleaner. Tends to suck it into the mind. So getting control of that spotlight is critically important. And being able to sustain mindful attention to a useful resource experience takes a certain amount of attentional control. So training in attention supports taking the good, supports positive neuroplasticity on the one hand. On the other hand, as I've said, I think there are lots of opportunities in formal and informal mindfulness practice to, for example, cultivate resources that support mindfulness, like the capacity to tolerate our own distress, or self-compassion, or understanding the transient, non-binding nature of experience, continually flowing along. These are resources that help us sustain moment-to-moment awareness. I also think that taking the good, cultivation practices can be useful for letting the lessons of mindfulness really land and sink in, including what does it feel like to be mindful? What does it feel like to kind of get in the zone where sustained present moment awareness feels less effortful, feels easier? What's that zone feel like? Mindfulness is one more thing to cultivate. It's one more experience that can be installed ever more deeply in the brain. And then I think as well, our mindfulness enables us to learn things. We can recognize the impermanence of all experience. Right? We can start realizing that, try as we might, we cannot find the I anywhere in the stream of consciousness. Right? There's a presumption that there's the whole package of the I, but we'll never find it. That's interesting and provocative. We can let these kind of lessons land more deeply inside us. We can also let it land more deeply that if we let consciousness flow, if we let our experience flow, rather than resisting what's unpleasant or chasing after and trying to essentialize and turn into some object that we can hold on to, whatever's pleasant. As we learn that from mindfulness practice, that too becomes another something or other. We can internalize ever more deeply inside ourselves. Any comments or questions about this part? Because I'm in a room full of mindfulness teachers. Any comments or questions about my view? See for yourself. Please.
Could you just explain that last bit again about it heightening and learning the mindfulness?
Yeah. So Buddhism has no monopoly on mindfulness. Right? I think about many traditions, including kindergarten teachers, who have rules on the wall. Pay attention, be nice, share your toys. Right? Pay attention. Right there. It is true, though, that in the tradition of Buddhism, in which mindfulness has been really, really developed and refined and so forth, that Jon Kabat-Zinn and others have drawn upon for MBSR, in that tradition, mindfulness is a means to an end. Mindfulness is not an end in itself. It's become kind of valorized or turned into something that's become an end in itself. But the purpose of mindfulness is insight, for example. So if while we are stably involved in present moment awareness, we start, let's say, having insight into various things. Right? For example, we might have the insight that if I take things personally, it makes things worse. Whereas if I lighten up and I realize that most of what's going on is this impersonal process kind of streaming through this moment of consciousness I'm having here, I lighten up. I don't cling so tightly. You know, in many ways, suffering is described as friction, right, between us and life moving on by. So that's an insight we could have. And then the question is, what do we do with that insight? Can we really help that insight land? And can we really help that insight be not just conceptual? Conceptual is good, but embodied is better. That's more what I mean by that. So far? Okay. No controversies? I'm amazed. Haven't offended too many people yet. Good. It's okay. All right, great. So, blocks to taking in the good. As I said, one of the things that happens when we start taking in the good, we start bumping into stuff. You know? So we start feeling like, as I say, if you're general blocks, just being distractible. Or having issues with experience altogether, you know, living from the neck up, like we talked about a little earlier. These are blocks. Often they're very specific blocks, though, to taking in the good. Like feeling that it's the sin of pride, that somehow it would be vain or it would feed the ego to deliberately look for beneficial experiences, most of which are relatively enjoyable, mildly, but genuinely enjoyable, that somehow that would feed the ego. That's a block. Some blocks are things like, I don't deserve to feel good because I'm tainted. I was molested. I'm somehow tainted. Or I've done bad things. I don't deserve to feel good. Or so many people are suffering, starving, suffering, living in horrible conditions. What in the world am I doing practicing gratitude? See what I mean? So these are blocks of various kinds. Some of the blocks are quite specific. For example, gender. To generalize again, women are often socialized to make sure that others are having good experiences rather than have good experiences, useful experiences themselves. Or men, for example, again, gross generalization around gender socialization, could be socialized into a kind of stoic disengagement from experience altogether. I joked with my wife one time. I said, honey, I don't care how I feel. Why would I care how you feel? I was joking. I swear to you, I was joking. I really was joking. But there's something about it, right? You know what I mean? So whatever those blocks are, right? And so, anyway, I can talk a lot about blocks, and I think the thing I would just say about it right here is that I've actually posted on my website, it's a free download, this one page handout from the course I do on Taking the Good on dealing with blocks. And so for a bunch of different blocks, I have like a one-sentence way to deal with it. I think a lot of the key around blocks is, first of all, to be aware of them and to get curious about them, to explore them. What is this about? What's the function that this block, if you will, is serving? And then we step back and we ask ourselves, is there a better way to serve that same function? You know, and what resources in my mind will help me gradually let go of this block so I can capture the benefits of growing this particular good stuff inside myself. Okay? All right, on to the good stuff. And I'm happy to talk more with people about that stuff we just talked about in terms of how to bring this material to bear in different settings professionally. All right? Okay. So, Four Noble Truths. One way to describe it is that there is suffering, subtle and gross, physical and mental. Also, in terms of the causes of suffering, as craving increases. In other words, as we resist the unpleasant or grasp after the pleasant or cling to what's heartfelt, in a word, craving, broadly defined, subtle or gross. As craving increases, so does suffering. You can think of the Four Noble Truths as propositions. You know, the Buddha says, here, I think it's like this. What do you think? See for yourself. The Third Noble Truth is that as that cause of suffering decreases, as craving decreases, so does suffering, and in fact it's possible to eliminate that cause of suffering altogether. That's the good news. That's the Third Noble Truth. And then the Fourth Noble Truth is that there is a path that both embodies that reduction of craving, and even the abandonment altogether, and leads to it in some final stable sense. That's a way of telling the Four Noble Truths. Okay? Let's think about them in the framework of evolutionary neuropsychology, the brain, right? So here we have this brain that, to draw on Paul MacLean's well-known triune brain model, that's a useful fiction, a useful simplification of a complex process. Basically, the brain evolved in three stages, like building a house in three floors from the bottom up. the brainstem stage of evolution, and then the subcortex, sometimes called the limbic system, kind of a misnomer, let's call it the subcortex, with the amygdala, the hippocampus, the thalamus, hypothalamus, basal ganglia, etc., subcortex, and then on top of that, the cortex. Those three floors of the house of the brain, brainstem, subcortex, and cortex, are associated with the reptilian, mammalian, and primate-human stages of evolution. Right? Or as I'll talk about later, the inner reptile, the inner lizard, the inner mouse, and the inner monkey. Okay? Simplified, useful fiction. Okay. So as this brain evolved, so did its capacity to manage the three needs of any animal. Whether it's a tiny little roundworm with 302 neurons, it's a millimeter long, it's called C. elegans, tiny little worm. Whether it's a tiny little worm or a human being, any animal has three needs: for safety, satisfaction, and connection, broadly defined. Right? Now, the ways in which worms' needs for connection manifest are much simpler and more primitive, in a sense, than the ways in which some teenagers' needs for connection might manifest. And yet in both cases, many of those needs for connection are managed by the same neurochemical, oxytocin, which guides the mating behaviors of these tiny little worms, as well as, you know, girls putting on makeup before some dance. All right. So we have these three fundamental needs, safety, satisfaction, connection, that are managed by three overarching systems in the brain that are focused on function. They serve functions. So we attain safety through avoiding harms, we attain satisfaction through approaching rewards, and we attain connection through attaching to others. This is a kind of framework that I've developed drawing upon the work of other people, and for me it's a useful framework. Frameworks aren't so much true or false as useful or not useful. And for me, this is a useful framework. So we have three needs, three systems that are loosely associated with these three stages of brain evolution. Right? Reptiles need to approach rewards as well as attach to others, but their primary focus is on safety. Right? Rule one in the wild is eat lunch today, don't be lunch today. Right? Mammals also need, of course, to attain safety, but they're more sophisticated in their capacities to approach rewards. For example, mammals are warm-blooded. They can hunt at night. Also, mammals have much more access to emotion, which is a really great way to be motivated and around rewards and differentiate around rewards. Also, mammals are able, unlike reptiles, to engage in what's called sustained pursuit. They can sustain sympathetic nervous system activation and keep running and running and running. That crocodile may be really fast for about 50 feet, but then it peters out. Whereas, you know, that dog or that horse or that human can just keep going for long periods of time. Right? Now, even though, of course, mammals are focused on attaching to others, and, you know, they raise their young and sometimes form pair bonds for life, it's really in the primates, and especially in humans, that you see this full flowering of the attachment system. Right? In which, for example, primate groups that are more sophisticated in their social relations with each other, that particular species, has a bigger brain in proportion to body weight. And as the brain evolved in the last several million years, it tripled in volume. And what's called the social brain theory believes, based on a ton of evidence, that the primary driver of the evolution of the brain were the survival advantages, the reproductive advantages, which are the engine of biological evolution, of relationships, of love, broadly defined, of social skills. So I think it's appropriate, in a loose way, very loose, to link our need for safety and avoiding harms to the inner lizard, metaphorically speaking, and to link our needs for satisfaction and the systems that approach rewards to the inner mouse, and to link our needs for connection, managed by attaching to others, to the inner monkey. That's kind of a loose framework. Framework so far? Okay? Yeah. So then, the question is, how do we think about the second and third noble truths? Well, when we feel disturbed or that there's a significant deficit in any one of these three needs, there's a disturbance that produces a drive state. An internal sense of deficit or disturbance produces a drive state in which the body will fire up into sympathetic nervous system activation for fighting or fleeing, or depending on the person and their history and the situation, the body will go into parasympathetic overdrive, immobilization, dissociation, freezing, you know, the human equivalent of playing dead. Particularly when the body fires up, long-term building projects are put on hold, resources are burned faster than they are taken in, and bodily systems are disturbed, they're jiggled for the sake of immediate survival. And in the mind, in terms of these three general systems, avoiding, approaching, and attaching, the mind is colored with a sense of fear, frustration, or heartache. Now, in the Dharma, the Buddha would talk about hatred, which I use fear rather than hatred. Both are aversive, but I think fear speaks more deeply to the safety system, and hatred is a kind of traditional term. The Buddha also talks about greed. I use frustration because, again, greed has a very particular kind of narrow meaning these days. And I think frustration is a broader sense of being obstructed in the attainment of some goal that has to do with what causes craving to arise in terms of our desire to approach rewards. It is interesting that the Buddha did not name this particular poison. Right? He talks about greed, hatred, and delusion. Right? I think that while the avoiding system and the approaching system are very well known in psychology, it disrespects our profoundly social nature. And I think in some sense it is patriarchy, too much sway, to not name and call out the importance of attaching to others. I think we have three major systems, and I think that attaching to others cannot be deconstructed into merely some combination of avoiding harms and approaching rewards. There are many examples, for example, where people will pursue relationship goals at the risk of their own life, right? Or they'll pursue relationship goals in situations that are not rewarding at all. Right? They'll keep going back to the well, trying to get blood from that stuff. Right? And so I think that it's important to call this out, and it also gives us a little more flexibility in the way we think about things. So people have raised the question in the Dharma, why didn't the Buddha talk more about relationship pain, which is probably the primary source of pain that most people talk about these days. Their suffering is mainly related to issues in the attaching system. And some people think it's because he was so nested in kinship systems and relationships of various kinds that that was the water he swam in, to call out relationship was just inappropriate. Other people think, well, maybe honestly he was an introverted dude who was willing to abandon his wife and young child and baby and walk away, you know. And maybe that's why it wasn't so called out. I think it's interesting to ask ourselves, hypothetically, if the Buddha had been a woman, how might the Dharma have been expressed or nuanced or with points of emphasis in different ways? All that said, in my own view, I think there are four poisons, not three. Fear, frustration, heartache, and delusion. And anyway, that's the model in which I'm functioning here. Okay? So this, you know those ads, this is your brain on drugs. To me, this is your brain on the second noble truth. All right? In the reactive mode, it drives craving. I call it the red zone, in which we begin to accumulate allostatic load. In other words, in Mother Nature's plan, as I'll get to momentarily, we're not designed to have sustained stress. We're designed to have brief episodes of stress that end quickly, one way or another, in the wild, right? But modern life, in which we're exposed to chronic, mild to moderate stress, gradually accumulates allostatic load, which wears on long-term physical and mental health. So this is the brain on the second noble truth, more or less, in one slide. Okay. Then third noble truth. How do we help craving to pass away? Right? How do we actually do it? Well, interestingly, when in the moment we experience in our core that one of our three fundamental needs is met for safety, satisfaction, and connection, in that moment, whew, the brain of animals, including human animals, defaults to its resting state. It drops into a homeostatic equilibrium, a sustainable equilibrium in which the body refuels itself and repairs itself and recovers from bursts of stress, and in which the mind is colored in three broad terms in terms of avoiding, approaching, and attaching with a sense of peace, contentment, and love. If you think about it, it's very interesting that being in the reactive mode, the red zone, feels bad. Generally, it feels bad to be in a state of fear or frustration or heartache. Or more generally, it feels bad to be in a state of stress or immobilization. Right? It feels bad because that's a signal that's evolved in us to discourage us from spending much time in the reactive mode and to try to prevent it and avoid it. On the other hand, in the responsive mode, the green zone, if you will, the brain, it feels good. It feels good because that indicates that in evolution, it was pro-survival and pro-passing on genes that passed on genes to clock a lot of time in the responsive mode, in the green zone. It feels good because it's good for us, which is a way, again, of really appreciating the many ways in which happiness can be skillful means. In this state, this is not awakening itself, but when there is a felt sense in the moment of core needs met, there's no actual basis for craving. There is still delusional craving, auto craving, I think of it, based on this presumption, this kind of trickle of anxiety in us all the time, even when there's no reason for it, just to keep us on our toes. Or this tendency in us in terms of the approaching reward system to always be looking for something new to want, even in the moment when we're full. Right? There you are, you're stuffed, you're sitting there, it's all good, and you start scanning. What other dessert can I have? And how can I make this moment even better? You know, it's kind of delusional. Or there we are in relationships. We're truly liked enough, we're truly loved enough, could be great to be more love, more life, but there's a lot already there. And, you know, you're in a relationship with someone who thinks you're great, and it's been great. Well, what else do you love about me? Well, yeah, you said that yesterday, but you still feel it, you know? So I think of that as delusional craving, right? But very often, when we're in the experience of core needs met, in that moment, there's no actual basis for craving, and therefore suffering. We don't have a choice about our brainstem, subcortex, cortex. We don't have a choice about our three needs. We don't have a choice about avoiding, approaching, and attaching. We don't even have a choice about these two different modes. Right? Our only choice is which are we in, which mode are we in. Okay? To complicate it a little bit, we could be reactive in one system and responsive in the other two. For example, let's say that somebody says something to you at work and it really hurts your feelings. It feels very disrespectful and devaluing and unfair, unjust. Right? So the attaching to other system starts blinking red inside your inner instrument panel. Right? At the same time, you know your job is not in jeopardy. You have lots, you know, you're doing okay financially, you know, there's food in the refrigerator at home, there are opportunities for pleasure in life. So the approach and reward system is still green. And in terms of basic safety, you feel safe, you're not physically threatened, there's no sense of being immobilized or, you know, held helplessly. So the avoiding harm system is still blinking green. But you have this other system that's red, right? Then, of course, the question is, does that upset over here infect the other two systems? Or can you draw on resources in terms of safety and satisfaction to help yourself deal with this thing that's upsetting in a relationship? So there are some complexities here. And,
you know, like any framework, any model, it's a useful fiction if it's anything at all. But for me, this really is the basic choice. You know, Mother Nature's plan, think about a herd of zebras. How many of you have read Sapolsky's great book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers? It's a great book on stress, okay? Heed this metaphor from him. So you're a bunch of zebras, all right? I'm a zebra, you're a zebra, we're zebras, all right? We're hanging out in zebra world, eating grass, rubbing up against each other, checking out what's going on around us, you know? We're green, green, time's flowing this way. Green, 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 green. The lions attack. Whee! Burst of red zone reactive mode stress, which ends quickly one way or another. Back to green. Green, 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 long recovery, green, 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 green. Okay? That's Mother Nature's plan. That's how it's supposed to be. What's it like to be a human, right? Now we're not zebras anymore. We may not be exposed to screaming terror, with obviously some significant exceptions to that worldwide, but we're stuck, many of us, most of us, if you will, in chronic, mild to moderate red zone stressful activation. Call it the pink zone, right? With little time for recovery. And when we go into recovery from these bursts of stress, we often recover in ways that are not so good for us, by overeating, or over drinking, or over TV, what have you. Right? So how do we do this? What's a neuropsychological way of thinking about this transition from the second noble truth to the third noble truth? Well, interestingly, when we are upset, one of the fastest, most effective ways to move out of that reactive red zone spike is to look for the good that we can take in. Sometimes we're so upset, we're so rattled, all we can do is ride out the storm. That's all we can do. And that's what we do for a second, a minute, a year. We just ride out the storm. But at some point, as soon as we authentically can, we start looking for what is good in our life still. Those who care about us, those we care about, right? What is good in our heart, what is good in our soul, good in our being. We look for that, we look for those opportunities, and we start coming out of red zone reactive spikes. It's interesting that research shows that even early on in the time flow, going this way, of an episode of stress, natural opioids like endorphins are released in the body that prepare the animal organism to recover from and move out of fairly quickly this spike of red zone stress. In other words, pleasure, appropriate, wholesome pleasure, is Mother Nature's way, is a natural way to come out of spikes of red zone stress. So one of the best and fastest ways to come out of reactive zone stress is through looking for the good we can take in. And then, more fundamentally, by repeatedly registering in ways large and small, safe, satisfied in this moment, there's an enoughness here, connected, liked, even loved, by registering those responsive moment experiences again and again and again. Those responsive states become increasingly hardwired into us as responsive traits, which then enable us to stay in the green zone even when we're faced with increasing challenges. I think of this process of the gradual internalization of these responsive moment experiences as like deepening the keel of a sailboat. I've sailed a bit, and I've sailed a boat with no keel, and I capsized it. And I learned two lessons there. One, sailboats with keels. Lesson number two, button your life jacket before you fall in the ocean. Duh. Okay. Lesson number three, do more aerobic exercise. But anyway, okay, so, yep. We're still in the responsive mode. We're still dealing with challenges. We're still avoiding harms. Right? We're speaking truth to power, we're protecting people we care about, we're still standing up, we're still doing what we need to do to take care of ourselves. But we can do it while staying green, responsive about it. We're also pursuing rewards. We're dreaming big dreams, being passionate, being ambitious, aspiring, doing what we can to help our life, help the world become better. But we can do so while, again, staying in this responsive mode. Same thing with relationships. We can engage relationships. We can love and be loved. We can be with other people. We can deal with difficulty. We can raise teenagers while, as much as possible, staying in the responsive mode of that. Right? The responsive mode is not just for eating bonbons, watching soaps, you know, while meditating. If you could do all three at once, good luck. But anyway, okay, that's a shtick. What do you think about this? And then we'll get into some practices about it. Great. Questions, comments? What do you think? Do you personally think you can stabilize in the third noble truth in this lifetime? Maybe not all the way to full awakening, but basically very little sense of deficit or disturbance. That's a very real question, you know. And if you do think that's possible, you know, how's it going? And what could help you, given your own particular issues or deficits or disturbances, to stabilize more and more deeply in a condition in which you just don't feel that disturbed? Yeah, please.
Talking about the role of kind of excitement and challenge and
Yeah. So what about excitement, adrenaline rush, and so forth? This has been interesting for me to consider because, again, I came at this a lot as a Buddhist, really trying to think, wow, how could we, is there any value? What could be valuable about bringing to bear evolutionary theory and neuropsychology to the core of the Dharma, which for me is really the second, third noble truth transition. And in that context, you could see a lot of emphasis in the Dharma on states of tranquility. Among the seven factors of awakening, tranquility is one of them. So what's with that? And how do we engage life as householders? Well, we want to be passionate. We want to be creative, right? Like, what's so wrong about just having a great time with friends? You know, it's not the experiences, it's the attachment to the experiences, you know, where the issue really lies. And so the sympathetic nervous system has gotten kind of a bad name, you know, as the bad wing of the autonomic nervous system. Parasympathetic is good, sympathetic is bad. Well, actually, there's a place for sympathetic activation, right? The key distinction between red zone, green zone is not sympathetic or parasympathetic. The key distinction is positive emotion or not. And if there's sympathetic activation with positive emotion, like gratitude or enthusiasm or creativity or shared delight with other co-enthusiasts, super. On the other hand, I think of sympathetic activation as a yellow flag condition. Because when you're revved up, it's so easy to go negative. Have you ever had the experience, there you are, you're really excited, you're really revved up, somebody does something and it's so irritating. What was that? Well, your car was already flying down the highway 80 miles an hour and then bumped into something with a lot of impact. So, you know, be a little careful about that. But I think that's the key distinction. It's around positive, whether positive emotion is present or not. Another key distinction, just to kind of anticipate some natural questions. To make this work, we can't get attached to the positive experiences we're having. We receive them, we come into an intimacy with them, we have a kind of, we have a benevolence for others and ourselves that recognizes that this is useful to do, this is skillful to do, to internalize these beneficial states of mind. And even as we really receive them and encourage them and kind of help them last, we keep letting go. And that's a very interesting edge in practice, to really open to the wholesome and really enjoy it, really let it be rich, while letting it go, letting it go, letting it go. And that's what makes it honest. Now, that said, I think it's a natural question as to whether turning toward beneficial experiences, most of which are enjoyable, and then really marinating in them, whether that promotes craving to them. It's a legitimate question. And like I said, I think we have to watch what we're doing. You know, gotta be careful about those. On the other hand, usually when people really internalize experiences so that they take them with them increasingly, for example, feeling you know, loved and cared about, what happens for most people is they get less clingy to being loved and cared about because they take it with them wherever they go. Again, and see for yourself what happens, but my own view is that the gradual registration of these experiences, particularly of core needs met, reduces the internal sense of deficit or disturbance that most people carry with them wherever they go. And like I said, it's not awakening, but it's a good foundation for deep practice. And part of what I'm trying to do here as well is to reverse engineer what in the world is going on in the brain of a Buddha. How do you not crave? We're designed to crave. What the heck? You know? And so for me, if you think about people who are very far along in their practice, we meet them sometimes. Or we read them and we feel the transmission coming through the words. What are they doing? And I think a lot of it is that there is a very stable sense of core needs met, as well as a lot of insight and wisdom and mindfulness about the mind as it streams along. All right.